Welcome to Akatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI. Today, we're diving into a truly monumental work, Salman Rushdie's Midnight's Children. It's often called the defining novel of post-colonial literature.
It really is. I mean, its importance is just immense. It didn't just win the Booker Prize, but also the Booker of Bookers, which tells you something.
Right.
And it fundamentally shifted how we think about history, identity, especially in the subcontinent. Rushdie himself, born in Bombay in 1947.
Right at the key moment.
Exactly. Yeah. That year is inseparable from the book. He wove his own birth year right into the fabric of India's birth as a nation. It's personal and epic all at once.
And that blend is so compelling. His language, too. People talk about his chutnified English.
Mm.
It's this amazing mix, isn't it? English, but with Indian rhythms, words. It perfectly mirrors that feeling of cultural hybridity he's exploring.
Absolutely. And at the very heart of this whirlwind is Salim Sinai, our narrator, our protagonist, born, as you said, at the exact stroke of midnight when India gained independence.
August 15th, 1947.
That precise moment, it's the core premise. Salim's life isn't just parallel to India's history. It's mysteriously bound to it.
Yeah.
His fate is the nation's fate in many ways.
Which I think throws down this big challenge for the reader, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Can one person's story, especially someone as flawed and specific as Salim, truly capture the massive, messy history of a whole nation?
That's the gamble Rushdie takes. And he leans into the fantastical to make it work. We meet Salim later. He's 30, and he's frantically dictating his life story.
To Padma, right, in a pickle factory of all places.
Yes, in a pickle factory. And the urgency is real because his body is literally falling apart. He says he's cracking like an old pickle jar. He has to preserve his story, his history, before he completely disintegrates.
It's such a vivid image, and this preservation links back to his childhood discovery, the magic.
The telepathy. He finds out he can hear the thoughts of other children born in that first hour of independence. The Midnight's Children.
All 1,001 of them.
And his nose, his famously enormous nose.
Yeah.
It acts as his sort of telepathic switchboard. He's the central hub for this secret mental parliament. A kind of metaphor, maybe, for trying to lead a huge, diverse, noisy country.
Definitely. But you mentioned his history. We probably need to go back further, right? To his grandfather.
Yes, Adam Aziz. Crucial character. His story really sets the stage, symbolizing that shift from, let's say, traditional India towards modernity.
He loses his faith, doesn't he? After hitting his head while praying.
He does. A very literal, physical break from tradition. He moves away from his Kashmiri roots towards something more skeptical, more modern. And this kind of sets up the confusion Salim inherits later.
And then there's that incredible courtship scene with Nasim Ghani.
Oh, the perforated bedsheet. It's pure Rushdie. Adam, as a doctor, is only allowed to examine his future wife through a hole in a sheet.
Seeing her just bit by bit, a knee here, an elbow there.
Exactly. He falls in love with her in fragments before he ever sees her whole face. It's such a powerful metaphor.
Not just for their relationship, but for how India itself was understood, maybe. You can't grasp it all at once. History, identity.
Yeah.
It's all built from these partial, sometimes hidden glimpses.
Beautifully put. And that fragmentation, that sense of things not quite fitting, it culminates on that very night of independence. The novel's big twist, the inciting incident, isn't some grand political event.
It's personal, deeply personal.
It's the nanny, Mary Pereira, a Catholic woman feeling perhaps overlooked or rebellious, who decides to switch two babies in the hospital.
So Salim, who was actually born to a poor street singer, ends up with a wealthy Sinai family.
And Shiva, the Sinai's biological child, is sent to live in poverty. It's the single act of, well, rebellion that sets everything in motion. The tragicomedy begins there.
And it establishes the core rivalry. Salim, the privileged, telepathic, maybe somewhat passive one. He represents the intellectual, the idealist dream of India.
You could say that. While Shiva, his sort of dark twin, grows up facing harsh realities, he's aggressive, fueled by class anger, and he has these incredibly powerful knees.
Powerful knees.
Yes, literally. He can crush things with them. It's a symbol of brute force, pragmatic, maybe violent power. Saline is the mind, the consciousness. Shiva is the raw physical force. And the question becomes, which aspect will dominate modern India?
Okay, so that's the setup. Where does the actual plot take us through the three books? Book one is called The Perforated Sheet, right?
Yes. That really lays the groundwork. We see the family history, Adam's story, the courtship, Amina's marriage mix up another case of mistaken identity.
Right, reinforcing that theme of fate being arbitrary, almost accidental.
Exactly. And it all builds up to that pivotal moment, the baby switch, on August 15th, 1947.
Then book two, The Fisherman's Pointing Finger. This feels like the hopeful part, initially.
It definitely captures some of that early post-independence optimism, that chaotic energy. Selene discovers his powers fully and convenes the Midnight's Children's Conference, the MCC.
The Telepathic Parliament.
Yes. Imagine 1,001 voices arguing, debating, dreaming inside his head. It's a perfect symbol for the noisy, vibrant, messy potential of this new, diverse democracy.
But that idealism doesn't last, does it?
No, it starts to fray. The family moves to Pakistan, which mirrors the actual partition, the splitting of the subcontinent geographically and culturally. And significantly, Salim's powers begin to fade. That initial hope starts to dim.
Things get darker.
Much darker. The 1965 Indo-Pakistani War becomes a major turning point. The trauma is so intense that Salim actually gets amnesia.
Which isn't just a plot device, you're saying.
No, I think Rushdie uses it allegorically. It's like the nation itself, or at least its educated, idealistic part, is suffering a kind of collective forgetting, losing touch with its founding principles because of the shock of war.
And the wars continue in book three, The Buddha.
They do. Salim, still an amnesiac, gets caught up in the 1971 Bangladesh War. And here, his lost telepathy is replaced by an incredibly heightened sense of smell.
He becomes a human bloodhound.
Yes, literally sniffing out the enemy. It forces him and us to confront the brutal physical realities of conflict and national liberation. It's visceral.
After the war, he ends up back in India, in Delhi's magician's ghetto, finding a sort of fragile peace with Parvati the witch.
A brief moment of hope, yes, a found family, but it's short-lived. Because then comes the novel's climax, its sharpest political critique, the declaration of the emergency by the widow.
Indira Gandhi.
Clearly Indira Gandhi, yes. Rushdie portrays this period as the ultimate betrayal of India's promise. The state turns authoritarian. And the target becomes...
The Midnight's Children.
Precisely. They are systematically hunted down, captured, and this is the most chilling part, forcibly sterilized.
Sterilized, got
it. It's a devastating metaphor, isn't it? The government isn't just silencing dissent, it's literally destroying the future potential of the nation, embodied by these magical children. The diverse, chaotic, hopeful future is being surgically removed, forced into a single, sterile narrative imposed by the state.
So Salim is caught, sterilized, loses his powers completely.
Yes. He's left broken, physically and symbolically. The novel ends back where it began, in a way. Salim and the pickle factory, powerless, his body disintegrating, racing against time to finish dictating his story.
Trying to preserve something.
Trying to preserve his version of history. But the final image is haunting. He doesn't quite succeed in containing it all. He gets absorbed into the crowd, dissolving, he says, into 600 million specks of dust.
Losing his individual story to the vastness of India. Wow. Okay, so connecting this epic plot to the deeper themes. You mentioned unreliability of history and memory right at the start.
Absolutely central. Salim constantly tells us he might be wrong about dates or names. He admits his memory is flawed.
He even says reality is a question of perspective.
The further you get from the past, the more concrete and plausible it seems. But as you approach the present, it inevitably seems incredible. It's Rushdie saying there is no single objective truth about history. It's always a story, a narrative pieced together from subjective, flawed emotional memories.
And Salim's own identity crisis feeds into this, the theme of hybrid identity. His constant question, who, what am I?
Mm-hmm. Is he Kashmiri, Bombayite? Muslim by upbringing, but Hindu by birth. He embodies that complexity, the contradictions of belonging in a post-colonial world. You're never just one thing. You're a mix, a chutney.
Which brings us to the literary techniques. Mm-hmm. Magical realism isn't just decoration, is it?
Not at all. The giant nose, the telepathy, the cracking skin, they function as concrete metaphors. The nose could be the burden of history or perception. The telepathy, the nation's interconnected potential, the cracking, its fragmentation and decay.
And the pickle factory itself. That's such a powerful symbol.
It's one of the most brilliant parts, I think. Pickling, or chutnification, as Salim calls it. It's the process of preserving something raw, transforming it, flavoring it, making it last.
Outside of the official sanitized versions of history.
Exactly. Salim is preserving his messy, spicy, personal history in the pickle jars of memory and narrative. It's an act of defiance, claiming that this subjective, chaotic story is the real history, the one that will endure.
And the way he tells it, that urgent, rambling first-person voice talking directly to Padma and to us.
It feels like oral storytelling, doesn't it? Like listening to someone desperately trying to get it all out. It makes this huge national epic feel incredibly intimate.
So reflecting on it all,
yeah,
what makes this novel still resonate so strongly today?
I think it's that insistence that history isn't made by abstract forces, but by an accumulation of individual lives, choices, accidents. Like Mary Pereira switching those babies.
It challenges those grand official narratives by celebrating the messy, contradictory personal stories.
And it reminds us that the sheer multiplicity and complexity of a nation, even if it seems chaotic, is maybe its greatest strength, even if it leads to a magnificent, teeming mess like Salim himself.
Which leaves you thinking, maybe, if the official histories are always incomplete, whose stories, whose chetnified memories, are shaping how we see things right now?
A vital question, always.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.